1 Corinthians chapter 16. We've been looking through this book since the autumn, coming down to the last chapter of this book. And it's an intriguing little chapter. It's quite different, really. Often you do find that at the ends of the books. The last chapter often is quite different. It's not really teaching. It's not as if Paul is wanting to sit them down and there's some last things I want to teach you. He's more just mentioning things, it seems. He's giving some news about things that are going on, some instructions, some plans of what might be happening next, there at the end of this letter. And yet it gives us a real insight into to life in these churches, like there in Corinth, and he mentions the church in Ephesus too, and these churches that were there in the early years of the New Testament. And we get this insight there as to something of practical church, if you know what I mean. After Paul has dealt with lots of matters of doctrine and various sort of principles and things that should be going on, then he just looks here as he just mentions various sort of practicalities of living together as a group of God's people. What's it practically look like to be getting on together as a family of God's people in the local church? And Paul here just picks up four things I want to just mention a little bit of. They all begin with P. And the first one is provision. Provision. It's in there in the first couple of verses. He begins verse 1, now concerning the collection of the saints. Now, he's used that phrase a few times before. And we've mentioned that it seems that this letter of 1 Corinthians was written in response to a letter they sent him. And so in chapter 7, verse 1, he begins in that chapter, now concerning the things which you wrote to me. And so it seems the church in Corinth wrote a letter to Paul about various topics that they were puzzled about or wanted his guidance about and so on. And so quite a few of the chapters after that start with that little phrase, now concerning such and such, picking up some of these things they want to talk about. And this is one of them, presumably, here in chapter 16, verse 1, now concerning the collection for the saints. Maybe they'd ask questions to Paul about that. And here Paul mentions he's given orders to the churches of Galatia too. And we can pick some of those up in some other letters. That Paul had given instructions of this sort to many churches before, either in written form or presumably he'd mentioned it when he was in Corinth and so on. And now they want to clarify that or something. Paul had given instructions to them to give them some guidance on what it means to financially contribute to God's work, giving money to support God's work. And here it was just mentioned in a couple of little verses. One of those things we don't try to make a big deal of. It's one of those things that Christians are sometimes, unfortunately, renowned for when churches keep making their big appeals for money and things like that. And we don't want to make a big deal about that and always be seem to be after money from people who are coming in through our doors. But here we just has a couple of little verses, just in this little portion here. And it seems that he was trying to get together a gift that's then going to go to Jerusalem, verse 3. It seems that maybe there was trouble there. It's mentioned in the book of Acts that there was persecution in Jerusalem. Lots of them had been scattered from the Jerusalem, and the church there seemed to sometimes bear a bit of the brunt of things. So maybe it was that, the believers who were suffering. Later in the book of Acts, it mentions there was a famine that was affecting large parts of Judea and Jerusalem. Although this might be a little bit later than that. Or maybe it was just the need to support, long-term support for the church there in Jerusalem. Maybe the people there were much poorer. It's hard to know exactly, but Paul here is mentioning their need. They seem to be aware of it. And Paul wants them to be getting together this gift. And it's a principle, isn't it? Of our need to support God's work and God's people who might be in need. And here we give some practical instructions about it. Then verse 1, now concerning the collections for the saints, as I've given orders to the churches of Galatia, so you must also do. On the first day of the week, let each one of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there be no collections when I come. He wanted their giving to be thoughtful and regular, not something haphazard. Well, not that they were going to ignore it for a good long length of time, for months and months, and then Paul would come and suddenly, we really should have set aside a gift by now. Let's have a quick rip round. Who's got a few pound coins in their pocket? Okay, that'll do. And send it off with Paul. Paul said, no. If you're going to give to God's work, it should be thoughtful. It should be deliberate. It should be something regular, not just a random emergency and you're digging deep to find a few pound coins down the back of the sofa sort of thing. As I said, you should think about it, and you should decide it. And most people, you know, he's saying there you should lay it aside on the first day of the week. He mentioned in other places in the next letter more that they would come together on the first day of the week, and it's linked to that. That this is part of an act of worship. So we have an offering box outside, and some people like to give something on their way into church. It is a part of our worship. As we give the worship, the sacrifice of our hearts and our words, there's also the financial gift we may bring as well in those things. Perhaps some of us actually don't often bring money with us, but it might nowadays all be sorted online and things like that, with standing orders and things like that. But still, it's a decision, isn't it? And a thoughtfulness has gone into it. He makes the point as well in verse 2, on the first day of the week, let each one of you lay something aside. It should be something that all of God's people contribute to. Everyone has some income, of varying sizes, no doubt. But everyone has some income that they're living on, and everyone can give something. It should be proportional to that. Here, and in the New Testament, and here Paul doesn't mention a tithe. That's talked about in the Old Testament. But it's left much more open than that, I think, in the New. Maybe it's a good ballpark figure. But there may be some who can give far more than that, and some who can't afford that. Even thinking of the Lord Jesus, who was watching the people coming into the temple. He saw the widow coming in who just gave two small little pennies. He said she's given far more than everyone else. Let each one lay something aside. Even if you are living very close to the breadline and can only manage two pennies, that is still seen as a sacrifice and offering that is given to the Lord. Paul seems to have to talk about it again in 2 Corinthians. Maybe they weren't particularly forward in their giving here in Corinth, because he has to talk about it again in the next letter. So it might be that. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 7, there's that quite famous verse in there that the Lord loves a cheerful giver. And that's what our giving is meant to be. Something cheerful, something generous, and knowing that we're giving to God's work. Then the last little instruction he's got about it in verse 3 then is what happens when the money is given. Verse 3, when I come, whomever you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem. And so when that money is given to God's work, the church as a whole needs to deal with it diligently and faithfully. And that needs to be the case, doesn't it? Again, it is very sadly too often that there are rumours and scandals of churches misusing money, skimming off some of the profits and things like that. We even have that in the Bible itself with Judas, don't we? Who was looking after the money for the disciples and for Jesus, and yet was taking the bits that he wanted from it. And Paul here says there should be none of that. So you should approve people to take care of this gift. It's brought in, it's set aside by each individual, and then it's put into a pot, as it were, by the church, and there should be people who are looking after that, who are responsible for that, who are known to be obedient and faithful in that. And that's a practical necessity. Paul says, I'm not going to do it. And again, notice his care in that. He doesn't want to get involved in that, and people think that he's the one taking the money to Jerusalem. And he says, well, I might come with you to Jerusalem, but your people are going to handle this. You should choose somebody in the church. And so we do. As a group of church members, we appoint deacons, don't we? We appoint a treasurer to keep a careful eye of things. Even when it comes to counting the money in the box, we make sure there's two people doing it together to make sure everything's above board and is all honestly and carefully being taken care of. And that needs to be the case, doesn't it? All too often the church has been brought into disrepute, even in the eyes of unbelievers. By the way, it's not conducting things properly and the way it should. So there's that practical necessity of provision and of dealing with financial matters in the church. That's something we need to be obedient to be those who are generous, cheerful givers, supporting God's work and God's people. Secondly, Paul has his plans. Plans. Paul, it seems, is currently in Ephesus. We mentioned that before at various points. Verse 8, I will tarry in Ephesus until Pentecost. So we think that Paul wrote this letter to the Corinthians while he was staying in Ephesus. It tells us in Acts chapter 19 that he stayed there 2 years. And that was the longest, it seems, that Paul stayed anywhere voluntarily when he wasn't in prison and things like that. But that was the longest period he stayed in any one place. And he was working there in Ephesus, planting churches, and it seems throughout that area then of what we call Turkey nowadays. And some of the other time, of course, he's writing letters like these. And Paul plans. He talks about it in verse 5. I will come to you when I pass through Macedonia. I am going to pass through Macedonia. And it may be I remain with you or spend the winter with you, and you'll send me on my journey wherever I go. I don't want it just to be a brief visit, but I want to stay with you if the Lord permits. And there Paul talks about some of his plans. But through it all, Paul's big concern was for God's work. God's work. And he says that there, mentioning Timothy in verse 10. And if Timothy comes, see that he may be with you without fear, for he does the work of the Lord as I do. The whole of this planning of Paul is geared towards God's work. That was the driving motivation in his life. Working for God, serving God. And so he stayed in Ephesus 2 years. And he was working there and then thinking ahead about when he might move on from Ephesus and head on somewhere else. He wants to go back through Macedonia through some of the other churches there in Philippi and Thessalonica and places, on to Corinth and so on. But his concern is for God's work. Is that our concern? Are we driven by the same thought of serving God? To Paul, everything was brought into line with that. And yet, do we always think about those same things when we're making financial decisions, when we're thinking about a job offer or a promotion? Do we think, well, is that going to help God's work or not? When we contemplate a house move or whatever it is, you know, are we thinking, what's going to serve God best? What's going to be best in his work? And that's what Paul was thinking about all the time. And so it should be our concern too. For Paul in Ephesus, he's staying there, he says, for 2 years. And he says in verse 9, for a great and effective door has opened to me. It seems that there in Ephesus that he found a good place that was quite accessible. It talks in Acts 19 about being able to welcome people in. There was a lecture hall of Tyrannus and things like that. The different places where Paul could minister. And it talks there that the word of God was going out from Ephesus to the whole area around. And so Paul seemed to find this key location there that was really good, not just for reaching the town, but the whole sort of county or whatever you might call it around there. And it seems lots of churches were planted and people were coming in, hearing the gospel and going out from Ephesus, taking the good news all around. And so Paul there stayed for this longest period, 2 years there, because he seemed to think it was really key, a really key place where the gospel seemed to be spreading. Quite well, it was a great and effective door, he says, that's open to me. But notice the next phrase, and there are many adversaries. That sounds a bit of a weird pair to put together, doesn't it? A great and effective door has opened to me, and there are many adversaries. Normally you'd have a but there, wouldn't you? But there are many adversaries. Or you say there was an open door, but now it's rubbish. Now it's all sort of closed down and there's all these problems cropping up. He said, actually, there's the two. There's possibilities and opposition at the same time. God's blessing it. There's great time here. The word of the Lord's going out through the whole area. And there's a lot of trouble at the same time. And sometimes those things are the case. We'd prefer to pick one or the other, of course. Like the wide open door, but not the adversaries. But often those two go together, as we see so many times in our look a few years ago in the book of Acts. And in Ephesus, of course, in the end, there was this riot, wasn't there, that went on there in that place as well, about the Demetrius, the silversmith, who was concerned about all their idols and things like that. And whether that had happened by now, or it's a little bit hard from the book of Acts even to sort of get the time scale of that, or whether that happened towards the end of the 2 years, it's a little bit hard to say. But there was this opposition that built up as well. But all this time, Paul's driving concern for God's work. And yet at the same time, it's also driven just by being sensible. Paul tried to make sensible, practical decisions. He wasn't one of these chaps who's sort of up in some ivory tower, just dreaming away about what would be best for the Lord's work, but he's a man with his feet on the ground, trying to sort of see what the options are there and then, right in front of him. And so at the minute he says, there's work for me here to do in Ephesus, but he's already thinking that maybe that'll come to an end at some point, or maybe others will be able to take it on better, and Paul may move on. He talks about wanting to pass through Macedonia in those verses we've read. And he says, I hope to spend some time with you, and even the winter. Oh, this is practical stuff he's talking about here. Yours would be a good location down there in Corinth, right down at the bottom end of Greece. I could spend the winter with you there, practical things, and that'd be a pretty tricky time to get a boat or something like that and head somewhere else. It's practical stuff, sensible stuff. He's there with his thinking cap on, not just dreaming up funny plans and this, that and the other. It's practical, sensible stuff. And so we need to do as believers. Can't be up there on cloud cuckoo land and just with wild, crazy ambitions and things. But it is practical stuff, sensible stuff that God uses to guide us. And Paul, quite honestly, talks about not really knowing what will be next. Verse 4, he says he might be going to Jerusalem. And so he may go with those who are taking the gift that way. But then he says in verse 6, I hope to spend the winter with you, and you can send me on my journey afterwards, wherever I go. Doesn't really know. Paul is content to be aware of that his view of the horizon is very limited. He can think about the next couple of steps that might be happening. He might move on from Ephesus, he might visit them in Macedonia and Corinth, but he doesn't really know. So that speaks a word to us, doesn't it? Sometimes about the dangers of planning too far. There's a sort of problem either way, isn't it? Some people don't plan at all, taken by surprise by everything and have no real idea what they're doing. And other people just seem to plan far, far in ahead and think they've got everything mapped out for the next 5, 10 years. And James, of course, when in his letter, will tell us, James chapter 4, said you don't even know what tomorrow's going to bring. And so we do need to have that practical, sensible ideas about the next couple of steps that may happen for us and the things we're trying to decide upon. But aware, there's so many things we don't know at the same time. Having that concern for God's work and at the same time having our thinking caps on and being sensible about things that are before us. And all of it submitted to God's will. All of those plans that Paul had, all of them are brought into submission to God's will. There in verse 7. For I do not wish to see you now on the way, but I hope to stay a while with you, if the Lord permits. Paul doesn't know. He thinks he's going to move on from Ephesus and go through Macedonia to Corinth and so on, but he doesn't know. He says, if the Lord allows. We'll see. We'll see if that does actually happen. I think it's a possibility. I think it makes sense. But now we'll see what God's will is. And it might not be that. It might be something completely different. What about us in this whole area of our plans as Christians? As we try and make decisions about the future, different things we need to decide, different things are there before us, practical things we need to make sensible decisions on. Always thinking about God's work and always realising that we want to submit those things to God's will. Thirdly then, he talks about the people. The people who are there in their church, Corinth, and people who are coming and going, people who are visiting. He talks about two of those visitors. First of all, Timothy in verse 10 and 11. If Timothy comes, again it's an if, not quite sure, see that he may be with you without fear, for he does the work of the Lord as I do. Therefore let no one despise him, but send him on his journey in peace, that he may come to me, for I'm waiting for him with the brethren. He talks about Timothy coming, that he may be coming before Paul does. Maybe just for a brief visit. Maybe he might be coming with this letter. He might be the delivery man, bringing this letter with others from Paul. Judging from the words, it seems that both Paul and Timothy are a little bit apprehensive about that. Going to this church in Corinth. Paul's had a lot of things to say over the last 16 chapters to the church in Corinth, and it might have been a tricky trip to be Paul's right-hand man delivering the letter. When Paul has quite a few strict things to say to them, a few stern words along the way. And yet Paul says to the church, make sure Timothy can come without fear to you. And when he goes, he should be going in peace. And that's what Paul wants to be done. And let no one despise him. It's quite strong things, aren't they, to say in their treatment of this visiting Christian. That they should be causing him no fear or despising him, but sending him on his way in peace. He talks as well about Apollos. Apollos, we know from the beginning few chapters and from what we read in the book of Acts, had been in Corinth before, and some people had become believers through his ministry, but there'd also been some problems along the way. And in the early chapters of 1 Corinthians, we realise there's quite a lot of arguments sometimes in the church between those who follow Apollos and those who follow Paul and others. And here Paul says, I strongly urged him to come to you with the brethren. Again, maybe those who are coming with the letter. But he was quite unwilling to come at this time. However, he will come when he has a convenient time. I think it sounds like Paul was hoping that perhaps Apollos could come with Timothy, or perhaps with others who are bringing this letter, to see if they could help bring some peace in the church, help reconcile some of these arguing factions of people. I think Paul sounds a little bit disappointed that Apollos isn't inclined to come quite yet. But Paul gives him that freedom to do that, and hoping that he will come when he has a convenient time. He talks about some who visit the other way as well. Some who come from the church in Corinth and have come to visit Paul. Verse 15, I heard you, brethren, you know the household of Stephanas. And then verse 17, I'm glad about the coming of Stephanas, Fortunus and Achiticus, for what was lacking on your part they supplied, for they refreshed my spirit and yours. And so it seems people came the opposite way. They'd come from the church in Corinth and they'd visited Paul while he was in Ephesus. Maybe they had brought the first letter the other way. And they'd come, Stephanas, Fortunus, and Achiticus. They'd come and they'd been with Paul for some time, and now it seems they're going back. And yet Paul says of them that he was so glad. I was glad they came, because they refreshed my spirit. Isn't that a beautiful little phrase? There was Paul working away in Ephesus. A wide door was open for ministry and lots of adversaries. Working hard and having some hostility towards that. And there were some who came, like Stephanas, Fortunus, Achaicus. He says, they were a breath of fresh air. They were refreshing to me. They were a help. When Paul was feeling a little bit down in the dumps, when he was dragging his heels a bit, they gave him a spring in his step. They encouraged him to carry on. And he did. He said, they supplied what you couldn't. Corinth, a long way away, but they came from you and they helped me along, they encouraged me, and on they go, and they supplied Paul's needs in all sorts of ways, perhaps. And that's an interesting thought, isn't it, to think about the people in the church, and even those who come and go in the life of the church. Are we refreshing? It's a funny question to think about, isn't it? Are we refreshing to be around? So people who come in, who are a bit down in the dumps, or are struggling, Christians perhaps, who are flagging a bit in their work for the Lord, do they find us refreshing? Wouldn't it be good if they did? Often in the summer months, and quite extended summer months, we have a steady stream of visitors through ABC, don't we? Living here in a holiday part of the world, we get all sorts of people coming in just for one Sunday, and then they're off on their holidays or heading home or whatever it might be. Do they look back at the time they were here and think that was refreshing? It was good to be on holiday in Ashbourne and go to that little church there in that funny building. It was refreshing to be there. Who knows who we might encourage? We might never meet them again. But we could be those who encourage them in their work in the Lord when they return to some other county or some other country of the world, having refreshed them. Wouldn't that be a ministry all of its own? Those missionaries who come and go and so on. Are we refreshing to others here like Stephanus and Fortunus and Achaicus. We know nothing else about them. They're refreshing people to be around, says Paul. What if our names could be on a list like that? Are we those kind of people? Paul was less sure about the church in Corinth, wasn't he? Timothy's going to visit you and I just hope it's going to be okay. It seems to be the way he's sort of saying, isn't it? There was a risk that Timothy could come visit the church in Corinth for a while and leave feeling afraid. And that he'd been despised. And that he'd faced the hostility from them. What an encouragement to us to think about the way we interact with those part of our church and those who are even just visiting and passing through. Paul wants to send greetings as well from other churches. So he sends the greetings from the church in Asia, he says, that's sort of Turkey, the area around Ephesus. All these churches, see, lots of them have been planted at that time, they all greet you. And he especially reminds them of Aquila and Priscilla, who greet you heartily in the Lord, and the church that meets in their house. Priscilla and Aquila had used to live in Corinth. Paul had met them when he was there. Then they'd moved on to Ephesus as well, it seems. And here Paul just reminds them of this godly, mature couple who they'd known when they were in Corinth. And he reminds them of them, and they're still working away. They're still hosting a church, meeting in their house. They send them their greetings. Paul wants to remind them of what it means to be mature. There's a lot of that in the letter of the Corinthians. The Corinthians liked show-offs. They liked people who had glamorous, flamboyant gifts, people who had charisma, people who had this great status, exuberant gifts. The people in Corinth were always attracted to that kind of razzmatazz and excitement. And Paul wants to remind them that's not the same as Christian maturity. Do you remember Priscilla and Aquila, he says? They used to be with you. They're still the same. They're still godly, mature people. They send their greetings. Talks in verse 15 of the household of Stephanus. Some of the first people who were baptized, he's mentioned them before, the beginning of the book, some of the first who became believers there in Corinth. And they've devoted themselves to the ministry of the saints, verse 15. If you've got an AV Bible, it has the curious phrase, they were addicted to serving the saints. Great translation there of the AV. All those years ago, they were addicted to serving the saints. It was their passion. It was their love. They were some of the first people who'd been converted there in Corinth, and they were addicted to serving. They couldn't get enough. They were always serving God's people. And Paul says about them, verse 16, you should submit to people like that. And to everyone who works and labours. Again, talking of Stephanus and Fortunus and Achaicus, who refreshed my spirit, he says, verse 18, therefore acknowledge people like that. Are we on the lookout for that? Paul reminded them to value those in the church who served. Not necessarily with great positions of prestige, in the spotlight of things, but those who are just in the background, Priscilla and Aquila, the household of Stephanus, just working away, serving the Lord, addicted to it. They loved it. They loved serving the Lord and his people. Are we on the lookout for people like that? That's the kind of people we need as elders and deacons, isn't it? We may give them those specific titles, but all sorts of us are called to serve the Lord in different ways. Are we those who look for people like that and want to be people like that? Lastly then, Paul brings his letter to a close just with reminding them of a few priorities. A few priorities. He's got these four little commandments in verse 13. Four little commandments. Watch, stand fast, be brave, be strong. Four little commands that they need to hear there in Corinth. Four things they needed to do. They needed to watch and stand fast, be brave and be strong. Paul picking up that idea of the they needed to stand firm. They need to remember the gospel. He's reminded them of that. Stand on it. Back in the beginning of chapter 15, when he was reminding those who were even thinking about denying Jesus' resurrection. He says, you've got to hold fast to that gospel. You can't let go of it. You've got to hold fast to that and stand firm for that truth that you have held. And reminding them again of that. Hold on to those things. knowing that there will be hostility, there will be temptations, we will experience doubts and fears. There may come in hostility from other people who question our faith or ridicule it or make us suffer for it. Be brave, be strong in those things that you do. Verse 14, let all you do be done with love. Recapping, isn't it? Chapter 13, when Paul talked to them in that beautiful chapter there, in that letter of the need for love. There to be love in that church in Corinth. Let everything you do be done with love. Let that be the motivation behind it. And he concludes with some of those same thoughts then right at the end. Of their need to show love to each other. He talks about those loving greetings that have come from other churches and Priscilla and Aquila. All of the brethren, verse 20, over in my neck of the woods, around here in Ephesus, they send you greetings, they send you love. Greet one another with a holy kiss. Show love between you. Make sure that the people you rub shoulders with, those you come into contact with at church and so on, make sure they know that they're loved by you. Whether we go around kissing everyone afterwards, maybe another thing or not, but all the same, are we demonstrating that love between us? And Paul wants to remind them of his love. This salutation is written with my own hand, Paul's. Somebody usually wrote Paul's letters for him. Some people think he might not have had very good eyesight and things like that. Anyway, so he might have dictated the letter to somebody else, but at the end he heads over and he says, I'm going to sign this with my own hand. It's a demonstration of his love, his greeting. Verse 24, my love be with you. He wants to demonstrate that love for them too. He wants to encourage them. That church there in Corinth, which was so fractured, so in danger of just falling apart. They're his final words to them, again reminding them of that need to love each other, to show it, to demonstrate it, as he's written this letter in love to them. And that's that blend we need to have, isn't it? As we're told in all sorts of things, whether we're talking with non-Christians, it tells us, doesn't it, to let all of our conversation be seasoned with grace. That'd be the truth and grace. And here he wants them to be strong and brave and be loving. That blend of those things working together, just as they do in the life of the Lord Jesus. And Paul reminds them of their need to love each other and then to love the Lord. Verse 22, if anyone does not love the Lord Jesus Christ, let him be accursed. O Lord, come. Some of his closing words there to them remind them there is just two options. There are those who love the Lord, and if you don't love the Lord, you're cursed. You are under the curse, still under that curse of sin and death and hell. And yet he's redeemed us from that curse. And if we have that genuine faith in him, realising what he's saved us for, then surely there should be that love for him. And that's Paul's, isn't it? Verse 23, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you. My love be with you in Christ Jesus. Paul has that love for the Lord, and that love he's then extending to these believers. He wants them to be careful. To be careful. For Paul loves the Lord, the one who saved him. And he wants him to come again. Oh Lord, come. Which one is it for us? Do we have that same priority? As Paul just closes with these things, are we those who are standing fast, holding on to that gospel that we've believed? Do we have that genuine love for the Lord? A genuine longing to be with him one day. And that love we want to show to other believers as well. There in this last little bit of that letter, here Paul tells us what practical life should be like. For those of us who are regulars here and for some who are visiting as well. Is that the way we want to practically work as Christians? To interact with those around us? Thinking of those priorities we need. Think of that sacrificial giving to the church. That serving. That looking around at other people and seeing the gifts that they have and the service they offer. All those plans we have as individuals or the church, bringing those things into submission to God.